quilts alongside our mom. My mother started to make a quilt from my poems, but never finished. As she made her quilts, my mother sang Christian hymns and old tribal songs. My mother made quilts. She would sew instead of sleep and sigh at sunrise. She once made a quilt with 30 Jesus faces, the shroud of too much. My wife doesn't quilt, so we don't have old fabric piled in the garage. I miss my mother. I miss watching her make quilts. Sewing was her art. My dad only slept on top of sheets and blankets layered on his bed. My mom only slept under many heavy quilts on the front room couch. When mom and dad slept, they rarely shared the same bed or the same warm quilt. My mom's arthritis turned her hands into fires fed by 10 dry twigs. How long do quilts last? I think they've discovered quilts in a pharaoh's tomb. My mother made quilts. She would sew instead of sleep and mourn at sunrise. How many coffins have been draped with my mom's quilts? Too many to count. When old quilts tattered, my mother would repair them. The quilt whisperer. Square by square by square, my mother constructed quilts and sold them for wood. Always cold, my mom often walked around the house quilted like a queen. Even wrapped in quilts, my mother kept our small house burning like the sun. In flames, we kids kicked aside our quilts and thirsted and desiccated. Square by square by square. My mom also abandoned and ignored her quilts. Ah, that poor half-quilt can only make a half-ghost that haunts half of us. A memory quilt is constructed with dark things you'd rather forget. I think I was raped on one of my mother's quilts, but my eyes were closed. Wrapped in my mom's quilts, I wept after funerals for so many friends. When my big sister died, I wanted to gather quilts and burn all of them. My mother made quilts. She would sew instead of sleep and collapse at dawn. Square by square by square, she punched anger through our skin and turned us into quilts. Wrapped around our mom, we quilts absorbed her anger and her fear and pain. Wrapped around our mom, we quilts absorbed her courage and her love and grace. Square by square by square, we quilts honor our mother and her strange genius. She taught us survival. With needle, thread, and thimble, all stained with her blood. Chapter 53. 3 days. 1. Why is it that I never remember how to spell resurrection? I have to internet search for the correct spelling every time. 2. 3 days after my mother's death, she rolls the stone from her tomb and walks into my dreams. Most people would insist that it's actually her, or her soul reaching out to me. But I'm not a literalist. I know, even as I'm dreaming, that my subconscious is only fucking with my conscious or vice versa. And yet, as I dream of an ordinary day where I take my sons to school, grocery shop, drive through for fast food, and browse a bookstore, my mother feels shockingly real as she follows me everywhere. She doesn't speak. She doesn't touch. She just follows me and follows me. She's in the back seat, smiling at me in the rearview mirror. She's knocking oranges and apples from the display in supermarkets. She's the barista making my coffee. She's the hum of the refrigerator. She's that tree heavy with crows. She follows me until the simple act of dropping ice cubes into an empty glass sounds like a thousand angels screaming with grief and rage. 3. Dear Mother, I am sorry that I don't believe in your ghost. I am sorry that you are a ghost. Dear Mother, I would call out your name, but I'm not the one who made resurrection more difficult to spell than doubt. Chapter 54. Navigation. Hey, smartphone, I'm lost. What am I supposed to do next? Dear Sherman, you must eventually forgive your mother. Don't forget. Wow, smartphone. I don't have the inner resources for that. Not yet. You better hurry. I've scheduled you for increasing amounts of regret. Damn, smartphone, that seems rather mean. Well, pal, just like me, grief is a relentless machine. So, smartphone, does this journey have an ultimate destination? You might get somewhere, but it won't be cause for celebration. Okay, smartphone, how do I take the first step, then another? I already told you, asshole. You gotta forgive your mother. Chapter 55. Sedated. And then, one summer night, when I was 17, my mother asked me to go find my father. He left home a week earlier on a drinking binge, and he had diabetes. After 7 days, we had to go looking for him. It was a family rule. We had arbitrarily decided that my father would only begin to seriously endanger his health after a week of booze and bad food. Plus, we'd get lonely for him. So I got into my car and drove from our home on the Spokane Indian Reservation to the Coeur d'Alene Reservation. My father, a supposedly full-blood Coeur d'Alene who had a suspiciously full mustache, had not lived on his reservation since he was a child. But that's usually where he went to drink. He was always trying to fill some indigenous absence. There were 5 or 6 party houses where I would search for him, and then, once I found him, I would have to persuade him to come home. My mother used to exclusively perform this family chore. But once I earned my driver's license, it was something I was often asked to do. My mother never commanded it, but she also knew I was unlikely to refuse the mission. So, on that particular summer night, I discovered my father asleep in a chair in our cousin's house in the little town of Worley, Idaho. He was barely conscious and smelled of beer, vomit, urine, and shit. I didn't want him to stink up my upholstery, so I walked back out to my car, grabbed the old army surplus blanket out of the trunk, and covered the passenger seat. Then I walked back into the house and tried to fully rouse my father. Most times he'd argue with me. He was never a violent man, drunk or sober, but he often deployed a drunk's persistent, if incoherent, logic that I'd have to overcome in order to get him home. But that time, when I woke him, my father was so hungover and exhausted that he got into my car without protest. And then, as I rolled down the car windows because of my father's stench, he tried to drunkenly explain our family history. "That was the year your mother was addicted to Valium," he said. "Wait," I said, "what?" My mother was a recovering alcoholic who'd sobered up when I was 7 years old. "Don't you remember when she was chewing her lips and tongue all the time?" my father asked. "That was the Valium. I don't remember that, I said. But I think I didn't want to remember it. My mother was often verbally cruel and emotionally unpredictable, but she was sober. I would only later learn that even a sober alcoholic can go on dry, drunk rages and sprees. But in any case, I preferred my angry, sober mother to my angry, drunk mother. And I hated to think that my mother's sobriety extended only to alcohol. You were little when it happened, my father said. That was when she started sleeping on the couch all the time, right? I asked. No, that was a different year. As we traveled through the pine forest, I desperately tried to remember my stoned mother. But I could not. I could not. And then I did. Oh, wait, I said. I remember when she thought she had MS and she was slurring her words. That wasn't MS, my drunk father said. That was Valium. And didn't she have a mini stroke once? Valium. And didn't she used to wear a blindfold because of migraine headaches? Valium, my father and I said together. I drove us into Wellpinit, the center of our world. Where did she get the Valium? I asked. I think that white doctor at the clinic was in love with her, my father said. So instead of flowers, I said, he gave her drugs. She was in real pain, though. What kind of pain? I asked. The pain of being Indian, he said. Oh, come on, Dad. That's why I drink so much. You drink so much because you're a drunk. No, my father said. I drink because I'm an Indian. I'm an Indian because I drink. I laughed at my father's bullshit. When I was younger, during my father's extended alcoholic absences, I would become inconsolable. But in my teen years, I had come to accept that my father would never stop drinking and would always leave home on binges. In order to survive, I think I'd learned how to love him a little less. I don't know what my mother did to survive his boozy sojourns, but hey, maybe Valium had been her temporary escape pod. How did Mom quit the Valium? I asked. One day, she said she was done with it, my father said. And she was? Never took them again? Maybe you should follow her example, I said. I was never mean to my father when he was sober, but I'd often insult and challenge him when he was drunk. So maybe I never did learn how to love him less. I don't know anything about my mother's strategies for loving him. I do know this sad fact. My father was at his most emotionally engaged with the world when he was somewhere between pretty damn drunk and all the way drunk. How am I supposed to follow your mother's example? My father asked, playing dumb. You're going to have to sober up someday, I said. That's never gonna happen, he said. He was telling the truth. My father died of alcoholism when he was 64. When I turn 65, I'm going to throw the biggest birthday party of my life. Daddy, Daddy, I'll sing, I lived longer than you. Chapter 56. At the Diabetic River. Salmon disappear. My father goes blind. He kneels on the bank, close to the river, so I can wash his face with the sacred water. Oh, the ghosts of salmon. Oh, the ghosts of my father's eyes. Chapter 57. Reunion. I release these salmon. I release. I release my father and mother. I release. I release these salmon into their personal rivers, the river of bitter root, the river of broken bone, the river of stone, the river of sweet smoke, the river of blood and salt, the river of semen and sap, the river diverted, the river dammed. I release these salmon, I release these salmon, I release, O salmon, I release you, O salmon, I pray, O father and mother, O father and mother. Mother, return to me, return to me. Chapter 58. The Spokane Indian Manual of Style. After the Grand Coulee Dam murdered our wild salmon, we stopped being Spokane Indians and became a paraphrase of Spokane Indians. Our identity has been clarified for us. We are the unsalmon people. We are unsalmon. We are un. Chapter 59. Testimony. 20 years ago, I sat in a room with more than 50 indigenous men from all over North America as they, one by one, stood and testified about being raped by white priests, white teachers, white coaches, and white security guards and soldiers. These rapes happened in residential boarding schools all across the United States and Canada, and they happened from the late 19th century into the late 20th. I had learned about the epidemic violence in Indian boarding schools, and I'd heard and read the countless stories of sexually abused women. But I had never seen so many male victims gathered together. One elder, over 70 years old, stood and said, "We were beaten for speaking our tribal languages. We were beaten for dancing and singing in traditional ways. We were beaten for resisting the beatings. Sometimes we would escape and run away. The white men would catch us and beat us for running away. They'd beat us for wanting to go home. They'd beat us for crying. So more than anything, we learned not to cry. Our tears were the only thing we could control. So not crying felt like we had won something." He said, "Sometimes white men would take you into private rooms and they would beat you, and you'd be happy to only get slapped and punched, because sometimes those white men would take you into those private rooms and rape you. Sometimes it was one white man. Sometimes it was more." The elder stopped speaking. He could not continue. He stood without crying and trembled. I watched him. That Indian man, over 70 years old, trembled like a frightened boy, like the boy he used to be and the boy he remained, trapped in time by his torture. That trembling man, that trembling boy, stood in silence for many minutes. And we other Indian men sat in silence and waited. We all knew, collectively, that we would silently wait for that man, that boy, to resume speaking, or to remain silent, or to sing or dance, or to cry, or to leave the room. We would have waited for hours, maybe for days. I think some of those Indian men would have let themselves die while waiting in that room. But that elder, that frozen child, smiled, placed his hand on his chest, and sat so he could listen to other Indian men tell their stories. And those men told their stories for hours. When people consider the meaning of genocide, they might only think of corpses being pushed into mass graves. But a person can be genocided, can have every connection to his past severed, and live to be an old man whose rib cage is a haunted house built around his heart. I know this because I once sat in a room and listened to dozens of Indian men desperately try to speak louder than their howling, 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 howling ghosts. Chapter 60, Pack Behavior. 1975, night on the reservation, summer, mosquitoes and moss following heat and light. In the treehouse, five boy cousins passed three porn magazines from hand to hand, their version of the internet. This is the USA. Deny it if you must. But nearly every American boy has been in a treehouse like that with cousins and magazines like that. There is nothing wrong with it. Three of the cousins pulled out their penises and masturbated, performed for the others. Deny it if you need, but that kind of performance has happened in many an American treehouse. There's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but depending on circumstances, there might be something wrong with it. The other two cousins, who were brothers, did not perform. Instead, they shyly climbed down from the treehouse and walked home. Why were two brothers, who grew up in a town of only 1,500 people, so unlike the three cousins who grew up in that same town? There are no provable answers, only psychological guesswork. Those brothers who went home? One of them has spent time in jail for DUI and unpaid fines. But the other brother has only been in jails to visit his brother. As for those other cousins, the ones who remained in the treehouse, all three grew up to be rapists. Two of them have spent years in prison for their crimes. The third cousin has never been convicted of any felony, though he has raped more people than the other two combined. How has that third cousin escaped justice? Because he mimics proper human behavior better than the others. Because he speaks a little bit of the tribal language. Because he genuflects and prays in front of large crowds. Because he wears beads and feathers every day of the year. Because he plays the role of traditional Indian better than most. Because he proclaims himself holy and is superficially believed. Because his victims have learned on the reservation and everywhere else that it is more painful and dangerous to testify than it is to silently grieve. On the reservation, testifiers are shunned and exiled. On the reservation, the silent are honored with more silence. In that way, silence becomes sacred. Silence becomes the tribal ceremony that everybody performs. Perhaps everybody, indigenous and not, lives on their own kind of reservation. If those five cousins were transformed into animals, into three wolves and two dogs, then this story might sound more like a parable, like a family fable, like an ancient lesson taught around the campfire. This story would teach us that dogs and wolves are alike. But the story would also teach us that in most ways, dogs and wolves are nothing alike. Dogs and wolves might have the same ancestors, but they long ago became members of different tribes. But how did dogs and wolves become so different from each other? Dogs are wolves that were loved by humans. Dogs were created by human tenderness. But wolves have always walked slow circles around humans. Wolves have seen humans only as potential prey and potential predators. But wait, you might say. There has never been a recorded instance of a healthy wolf attacking a human. But ah, the storyteller replies, did you hear me claim that those wolves, those three cousins, were ever healthy? Did you know that wolves will hunt other wolves? Did you know that wolves will eat their young? Did you know that wolves teach other wolves how to be wolves? Did you know that wolves beget wolves? Did you know that some wolves will dress up as Indians and dance and sing and dance and hunt and sing and dance and hunt and sing and dance and hunt and hunt and hunt and hunt all night long? Do you understand how one small dog, afraid of the wolves who had attacked him and those who would attack him anew, might stand on his hind legs, might evolve in a moment so he could run away and never return? Chapter 61, Prophecy. The salmon have built mansions at the bottom of every ocean. Thousands of rooms. Thousands of rooms. The salmon have sent ambassadors to live among Indians. Thousands of salmon. Thousands of salmon. Those ambassadors are teaching us how to breathe water. Chapter 62. Welcome to the Middle-Aged Orphans Club. 1 week after we buried my mother and 4 years after we buried hers, my wife and I went to see Wicked, the musical, for the third time. But that was the first time that my whole body ached as the Wicked and Good Witches sang their final duet. Why am I hurting like this? I asked my wife later. And she said, your mother, who was wicked most of the time and good some of the time, she just died. And you've only begun to reconcile the two mothers who lived inside your one mother. Oh, I said, amused at my emotional blindness. My mom wasn't even that sick when I bought the tickets, I said. I wasn't thinking about her then. We're always thinking about our mothers, my wife said. Because when it comes to death, you and I are up next. Chapter 63, Performance. On stage, in Bellingham, Washington, during a fundraiser for salmon restoration, I pointed out to an audience of 800 that salmon go on their epic journey from the ocean into the insane mouths of rivers and up those rivers against the current, over dams, dodging bears and fishermen, and a lot of those fishermen are Indians, by the way, and then through and over and around trees and rocks and pollution and garbage, swimming hundreds, even thousands of miles in order to fuck. Salmon, I said, are the most epic fuckers in the animal kingdom. The audience, crunchy-assed liberals one and all, laughed, but not with the abandon I wanted to hear. Maybe they were socially and politically progressive, but I could feel their sexual repression, too. I could sense that shitloads of them were offended. I was being inappropriate. After all, man, we had gathered to save the salmon, not to talk about sex. So honestly, I said, unafraid of being even more inappropriate. When we celebrate salmon, we are celebrating fucking. And I don't think we celebrate fucking enough. In fact, forget salmon for a minute. Let's talk about our mothers and fathers. I mean, have any of you ever thanked your parents for fucking and conceiving you? And I don't mean thank them all cute and poetic like, oh, I light this ancestral fire in tribute to you for my human creation. No, I mean, have you ever looked your mother and father in the eye and said, thank you for fucking me into existence? The audience laughed louder. I knew I'd won over a few more of them, but I wanted to win all of them. So I went stuntman. In fact, I said as I pulled out my cell phone and held it close to the microphone, "My father is dead, but I'm going to call my mother right now." I heard gasps in the audience. Some woman shouted, "No!" The moment was hugely uncomfortable, very funny, and comedically dangerous. It was dangerous because I didn't know if my mother was home to answer the phone. One ring. "Please be home, Mom." Two rings. "Please don't be the machine." Three rings. "What am I going to do if it's the machine? If I leave a message, will it be funny?" "Hello?" My mother answered. "Thank God." "Hey, Mom," I said, "I'm on stage in front of about 800 people in Bellingham and we're trying to save the salmon, and I just wanted to thank you for fucking Dad and conceiving me." The audience laughed. My mother laughed. "So what do you think about that?" I asked her. She said, "I think you sound like you're drunk. Have you been going to your AA meetings?" The audience laughed and laughed. I held the cell phone in the air as they laughed. That laughter was a celebration of my mother. She had won everybody in the room. Chapter 64. Electrolux. 4 in the morning, and our mother was vacuuming. That was one of her ceremonies. She often stayed awake all night to make quilts, or to bead powwow regalia, or just to watch TV. On those sleepless nights, she was usually content to be alone, to keep the peace. But on other nights, she needed to disturb all of us. So she'd plug in that old wheezing vacuum and slam and clunk around the living room. We lived in a small house, so there was no escape from the goddamn racket of her loneliness. Whirr, 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 fuck you, vacuum. Whirr, 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 fuck you, Mom. She knew my siblings and our father would stay in bed and pretend to be asleep. Maybe they'd even learned how to sleep through all of the forms of our mother's mania. Most of the time, they passively accepted our mother's contempt. They rarely confronted her about any of her bullshit. But she knew that I would stand up to her. She knew that I would storm up the stairs to curse at her. Once, I unplugged the vacuum, opened the door, and threw it as far as I could into the dark. It smashed to the ground. I hoped I'd broken it. But it only knocked loose a rib or something structural, because that vacuum kept working, but thereafter rattled like a snake made out of tin cans. Whirr, 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 don't take the fucking bait. Whirr, 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 whirr. She wins if you engage with her madness. How many times had she woken us that way? 30 or 40 times over 20 years? Not nearly enough for it to be predictable. No, she always surprised us with that shit, and I would furiously react. But one night, I didn't react. I covered my head with my pillows and tried to fall back asleep. She kept vacuuming. I refused to fight. She refused to turn off the vacuum, a stalemate that lasted until dawn. Later that morning, as we all ate breakfast, dark-eyed from lack of sleep, we all joked around as if it were another normal day in the Alexei household. But we didn't make jokes about our mother's vacuuming. We didn't address that at all. Whirr, 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 whirr. Don't talk about the shit that is troubling you. Whirr, 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 whirr. Swallow every indignity, small and large, without editorial comment. I don't know what happened to that vacuum. I imagine it finally broke for good. It's probably buried deep in the reservation landfill. Maybe some 27th century archaeologists will find it. They'll think it was just a primitive cleaning device. They won't know. It was a non-lethal weapon in a domestic war. Chapter 65, Love Parade. My mother married a war orphan. For the ceremony, he sported a three-piece grief. She was lovely in a white dress. A former child bride now marrying again as a woman. They wed on impulse in City Hall after being witnesses to their friends' equally impulsive marriage that only lasted months. But my mother and her war orphan were married for nearly four decades, conceived four children together, raised another only biologically hers, sheltered a dozen cousins for days and weeks and sometimes years, and officially adopted one cousin and raised him as their son. All of us, we brothers and sisters and cousins, were parented, well and not well, by my mother and her war orphan. We were raised by two kinds of loneliness. One was silent and solitary and depressed, while the other rehearsed lines, sought out the crowd, and confessed to everything. So yes, I am the child of those two opposing forces. I am the one who is half monk and half clown. Look at me pray. Look at me pratfall. I will beg. I will beg for your devotion. Then do my best to lead you astray. Chapter 66. The Urban Indian Boy Enjoys Good Health Insurance. Though I drove to the res and back and sat in bad chairs for 3 days straight, my chronically injured back somehow didn't collapse, so I made it through my mother's funeral and wake. But 11 days later, my back spasms in Seattle when I open our front door and I have to lower myself to the floor. Hello, Mr. Grief. I was wondering when you would find me where I am weakest. Look at me, push myself across the floor with one leg extended like an eccentric baby. At first, I crawl for the pain pills, then remember that I'm the recovering drunk who threw them away. So I force myself to my feet and slowly pace the breadth and length of the hallway because using my re-torn muscles is the best way to regain their strength. Chapter 67. The Raid. In the 13 days and 12 hours since we waked and honored and buried my mother, I've murdered 65 carpenter ants in my now invaded home, with spray, traps, magazines, books, spoons, and all of my shoes. I stomp, I stomp, I stomp, I stomp and stomp on those three segmented gods and see with each death that retribute is a verb that's terse, lovely, and sadly underused. Chapter 68, Ursine. Driving my son to camp, I saw a black bear rise on its hind legs to watch us roll by. A few hours later, after dropping off my son, I drove past that same spot and realized that black bear was a small tree, burned, split, and twisted by lightning. How had I confused a tree for a bear? I didn't need to see a bear. Minutes later, in a little town, I was bemused to see my mother strolling on the sidewalk. She'd been dead for a month. Oh, hello, ghost. I waved. She waved back. and then she tripped and fell hard. Oh, shit. I pulled off the road, jumped out of my car, and ran back to help my mother. But wait, it wasn't my mother. It was a white woman who fell. She smiled as I helped her to her feet, and I wondered what other ghosts might appear. "Are you okay?" I asked. And the woman said, "I mostly fell on the grass. Yes, I am good." She thanked me and strolled away. Another story to tell, I thought as I walked back to my car, about how everything I see and believe is contradicted by everything else. But I am okay with my lack of faith. I don't feel sacred or afflicted. I mean, hey, I get why people are desperate to fit this copious world into one prayer. But as for me, I'll be the secular clown, happy to mistake his late mother for a bear. Chapter 69, Persistence. On a Saturday afternoon, sometime in the mid-1970s, I walked home from my friend's house to discover my mother in our kitchen, loading canned food into a cardboard box. My mother often cooked for funerals, but I hadn't heard of anybody dying, and I wasn't sure how a few cans of baked beans and evaporated milk would feed dozens of mourners anyway. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Giving food to the O'Neill family," she said. "But not the Kling peaches," I said, worried. I loved the Kling peaches. The O'Neills were a poor white family who'd moved to the reservation a few months earlier. It wasn't unusual for Indians to marry white folks and create biracial families on a reservation. But the O'Neills, a mother, father, and approximately 7 sons and daughters, weren't friends or family with anybody on the res. They were an entirely white family who had suddenly appeared like a magician's rabbits. Why would a family choose to live on a strange reservation among Indian strangers? I would guess it had something to do with the O'Neills' extreme poverty. There were lots of poor Indians on our reservation. I'd say the poverty was almost universal, save for the few dozen people who worked for the tribe or the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But the O'Neills were so poor that it boggled our poor Indian minds. They wore the same gingham dresses and denim overalls to school every day, and their shoes and boots were repaired with generations of tape, string, and pieces of random fabric. I don't know how much time John Steinbeck had spent on Indian reservations, but he could have written the O'Neills into existence. At school, a few days after their arrival, the O'Neill kid in my class, Bobby, sat beside me at lunch and attacked the food. He open-mouthed chewed, choked a few times because he was eating so fast and finished his tray in seconds. I'd been hungry many times in my life. When I was 7 years old, I once went 32 hours without eating, as my parents were out looking for money like subsistence hunters scouting for deer. 32 hours is certainly not a physically dangerous amount of time to go without food. But it was scary. I hadn't known when I would get to eat again. And as my hunger grew, I'd wondered if I would ever eat again. But I'd experienced only a hint of what it truly means to be hungry. I had never felt as ravenous in my life as Bobby O'Neill appeared to be on that bright afternoon. He must not have eaten for days and days. And I would later learn that the 5 school lunches that he received were often the only food he'd eat that week. "Can I have more?" he asked me after he licked his tray clean. "Yes," I said, "if they have extra." "Really?" he said. I nodded. He started crying. From gratitude, I guess. He was sitting in the lunchroom of one of the poorest schools in the state, and he was sobbing because there was a chance of getting a second helping of tater tots and mysterious gravy. If I'd had the literary vocabulary, I would have recognized the situation as a tragic comedy. He stood and picked up his empty tray.
You have to wait until they give the signal, I said. And then you get in the line again, but be nice, or they won't serve you.
Bobby crouched with his tray, as if he were in the starting blocks preparing for the 100-meter dash. I remember looking at his legs, tensed in anticipation and marveling at his muscular calves. He was a skinny, malnourished kid, but even at his most hungry, he ran faster than everybody in the school. And, as he ran, Bobby would slap his ass and neigh like he was the jockey and the horse. I wonder now what kind of amazing athlete he might have been if coached and parented and fed properly. I don't remember much about the other O'Neill kids. One of the girls was shockingly beautiful even in her ragged clothes and kitchen table haircut. But Bobby was treated like shit by us Indians. I suppose you'd like to believe that I, as a severely bullied kid who grew up into a reflexively compassionate adult, would have befriended Bobby. That was not the case. I wasn't physically mean. I never slapped, punched, or kicked Bobby, and I don't recall ever taunting him. But, after talking to him a few times during his first week at school, I learned to flee whenever he approached. I ostracized him as completely as everybody else did. So on that day, when my mother packed canned goods into a box meant for the O'Neills, I didn't join in while singing work camp songs. Instead, I was angry. It's not like our family enjoyed a surplus of nutrition.
"Why are you giving them the cling peaches?" I said. "Those are my favorites." To reiterate, I adored the cling peaches.
In response, my mother quoted a Bible verse. I don't remember which one. Throughout my childhood, we'd all endured our mother's periodic evangelical Christian fervors. She'd quoted hundreds of Bible verses at us, so they all blur together in my memory. If I had to guess at what she'd quoted while packing canned food for the O'Neills, I'd go with Matthew 7:12. And now, since I realized those canned goods had probably been given to us as charity, it seems that, on the reservation, the golden rule could be translated as, "Hey, let's pass the same unopened can of shitty-ass chip beef around like it's contagious." After my mother finished packing the food, she made me drive with her to the O'Neill's house, a dilapidated shack that had been abandoned at least 20 years earlier. Half of the roof had collapsed, so the O'Neills had rigged and roped old plywood boards to act as some kind of semi-roof. It certainly wouldn't be roof enough when the rain and snow arrived.
"What are they going to do for winter?" I asked my mother.
"The pastor will fix it," she said. Pastor Rob, the Assembly of God minister on the reservation, also had some serious carpentry skills. Talk about Jesus-like, right? "Stand a car," my mother said. She carried that box of canned goods to their front door and kick-knocked with her right foot. I was nervous. In those days, I was wary of white people. Hell, I'm still wary of white people. But I have physical strength and money now. After a few moments, a white man opened the door. Bobby O'Neill's father, I assume. I wish that I could describe him. But in my memory of that day, I can see only a pale blur talking to my mother. I do remember that he yelled and cursed at my mother. I do remember that he pushed the box of food that my mother was holding. He didn't push violently, but it was enough to make her step back. Then he slammed the door shut and left my mother standing shocked and silent. She took a deep breath, then walked back to our car. She set the box of canned goods in the back seat, sat behind the steering wheel, and stared into the distance. "What's wrong?" I asked. He doesn't want charity, she said. We silently sat for another minute or two. I watched my mother making a decision. I wonder what Bible passages she was quoting to herself. Then she got out of the car, grabbed the food from the back seat, and walked toward the house again. I was terrified. What would I do if the O'Neill man got even more angry? What if he became more violent? I opened my car door a few inches. On the reservation, I'd been conditioned to throw the first punch, regardless of the enemy's size and strength. So I was ready to fight to protect my mother. I was, like all of the kids on the reservation, a child warrior. Holding that box of food, my mother stood at the front door. In the car, I was almost crying from fear. My mother lifted her leg, as if she were going to kick-knock again. I opened the car door a little wider to give me more room to quickly exit the vehicle. Then, without knocking or making a sound, my mother set down that box of food at the O'Neill's front door and walked back to me. We didn't say a word as we drove away. But my mother must have been terrified, too, when she'd approached the O'Neill house for the second time, when she decided that she would risk the fact that the white man's pride and shame might turn into absolute rage. She tried to find some music on the radio, but reception was even more random in those days than it is now. So we rode in silence for a while. Then my mother sang. But she didn't sing a Christian hymn. No, she sang her favorite song of the moment, a country ballad by Jesse Coulter. I'm not Lisa. My name is Julie. Lisa left you years ago. My mother had a beautiful voice. I loved it when she sang. She kept singing all the way home. And yes, I am still pissed that she gave away the Kling peaches. Chapter 70, Ode in Reverse. This poem is for everyone in my life. My sons, friends, mother, siblings, and my wife. It's a cuff to the head, a self-rebuff. Dear ones, I have not loved you well enough. Chapter 71, Construction. Sherman, my wife said after reading this memoir for the first time in its entirety. Your book is constructed in fabric squares like one of your mom's quilts. I meant it that way, I said. But that's a half-truth. I realized I had constructed a quilt of words only after I'd read my own damn book for the first time in its entirety. And then I saw the patterns and repetition of patterns. I saw the stitches and knots. I saw that my hands had worked in the same way that my mother's hands had worked. Fabric square ad infinitum. My mother, the quilter, will always haunt me. Chapter 72, Freedom. In February 1979, I came home from the reservation school and told my mother and father that I needed to leave. I wanted to go to college and become a pediatrician, and that would never happen if I stayed in the reservation school system. I'd been trying to escape the res for years. After all, Indian reservations were created by white men to serve as rural concentration camps, and I think that's still their primary purpose. So of course I ran away from home in third grade. I packed a small bag with comic books, peanut butter sandwiches, and my eyeglasses, and made it almost 2 miles down the road before my mother found me. After that incident, she often said, "Junior, you were born with a suitcase in your hand." That might have been a complimentary thing to say to a nomad. But my tribe hadn't been nomadic in more than a century. So when I came home that cold winter day in 1979 and asked my parents to let me leave the res school, I wouldn't have been shocked if they had denied me. I was only 12 years old, and I was asking them to let me abandon the tribe and become an indigenous refugee in the little farm town of Reardon. "Can I leave?" I asked them. And my parents, knowing that I was betraying thousands of years of tribal traditions to go live among white people, said, "Yes." My parents, as wounded and fragile as they were, had the strength and courage to set me free. I think they knew I would never return. Not in body or spirit, but they loved me too much to make me stay. Chapter 73, Chronology. In early September 1980, my father drove my big brother Arnold and me from our home on the Spokane Indian Reservation, 20 miles south, for my first day of 8th grade and my big brother's first day of 11th grade in Reardon, Washington. My brother and I became the only Spokane Indians in the Reardon School District, which was 99% white. We were brown kids in a sea of white kids inside an ocean of wheat fields. I'd made the decision on my own to leave Wahlpenet, but I don't remember why my big brother had followed my lead. He was a great basketball player, and Reardon had a legendary sports program, so I can only assume he transferred for athletic reasons. He and I were brothers, but I think he'd always been emotionally closer to his reservation Indian friends and cousins than he'd ever been to me, which explains why he dropped out of Reardon before Thanksgiving and returned to the res school. I love my brother. And I didn't want to be alone in a white town. I didn't want to be the only one. So I almost followed him back to the res. But then I didn't. Because the thing you learn as a hugely ambitious Indian is that you're often going to be the only Indian in the room. So you'd better get used to it. A couple of weeks before school started, my mother's brother, Leonard Cox, had died of cirrhosis. He was a gregarious alcoholic and gave me $1 bills whenever he saw me. At the end, his belly was so distended and black that my mother said, "He looked like an orca." So I walked into that new school with multiple griefs. As I lost my uncle, I had also untethered myself from my tribe. I was terrified. And then it got worse. On October 22nd, 1980, only a few weeks into school, my mother's mother, Etta Adams, Big Mom, died of cancer. Big Mom's funeral was so crowded with Indian family, friends, and strangers that I was able to sneak out and walk home to mourn alone. Before she died, Big Mom had given me a battery-powered wall clock that didn't work even with batteries. Yes, my dying grandmother had gifted me a hell of a metaphor. But I wasn't thinking about metaphors on that day. I lay on my bed, held that stopped clock against my chest, and mourned. Like my mother, I would often turn sleep into a weapon of self-defense. Or, if unable to sleep, I would throw the blankets over my face, turn toward the nearest wall, and pretend to sleep. Like my mother, I would turn my insomnia, my inability to sleep, into a weapon. After her mother's funeral, my mother stayed in bed for 2 days. Then, early in January 1981, less than 3 months after Big Mom's death, we learned that my big sister, Mary McCoy, and her husband Steve McCoy
had died in a trailer house fire in St. Ignatius, Montana. The fire started during a party. My sister and my brother-in-law were drunkenly passed out in the back bedroom,